So you want to hide her away? You really think that's best for her? Trying to convince her to stay in some asylum? The word rang in the air.
Oh, David, please.
My mother's voice lowered to a whisper.
You know they're not like that anymore. They're not even called asylums. It's a mental hospital.
I hurried to the living room and curled up on the couch, drawing my blanket tightly around me. So much for feeling good. My mother had removed my intestines and used them to tie a noose around my neck. She just hadn't kicked the stool out from under me yet. She couldn't send me to one of those places. She was my mother. She was supposed to do what was best for me, not what would get me out of her hair the fastest. How could she even think of that? It took a while for me to notice the big blue eyes watching me from the doorway. Come here, Charlie. I spread my arms. Charlie hesitated, then ran across the room and climbed into my lap. I wrapped my arms and the blanket around her. She saved me from trying to figure out how much I should tell her. I don't like it when your head breaks. I knew she was old enough and smart enough to know that my head didn't actually break, but she'd been calling it that for so long it didn't matter anymore. I think it made her feel better to think of it like something broken that could be fixed. I don't like it either, I said. You do know why it happens, right? Why my head breaks? Charlie removed the black castle from her mouth and nodded. The brain chemicals make hallucinations. And do you know what a hallucination is? She nodded again. I looked it up. Word of the week, maybe? I hugged her tighter. You know how you didn't want me to leave for that party a while back?
Mm-hmm.
And how you didn't want me to go to the hospital 3 weeks ago?
Yeah?
I took a breath, pulling myself together. Better to prepare her for the worst than let it blindside her. My parents would never tell her this. Not until it was too late. Maybe, if I told her now, if I prepared myself, too, I could still avoid it. Well, I might have to go away again. And it won't just be for a few hours or days or weeks. I absentmindedly pulled a bit of her hair back and began braiding it. Okay? I might not come back. I wanted you to know.
Do Mom and Dad know?
Charlie whispered.
Yeah, they know.
It was better if she didn't know that it was our mother's idea. She'd figure it out one day. But for now, she could go on believing that some higher power sent me where it thought I needed to be. She could keep trusting Mom and Dad, and keep being my whining, chess-playing, crusading Charlemagne. Chapter 19 Mono was my cover story. Everyone believed me. Everyone except Miles, Tucker, and Art. Art, because he'd carried me during my episode. Tucker, because his parents were doctors and he could tell when someone didn't actually know the symptoms of mono. Miles, for obvious reasons. I did my perimeter check 3 times while I hid Irwin behind his bushes on the front walk, and my eyes were drawn again to the roof, where the men in suits monitored the parking lot. It took me a few minutes to realize that public high schools don't have men in suits watching their parking lots. I took a picture of them. I wasn't sure if the pictures would help anymore, but doing it made me feel better. Like I was doing something to help myself. Like that was still possible. I still had so much makeup work, and no clue how to do most of it. When I slouched into the cafeteria after 4th period, I spent the hour doing homework instead of eating. I didn't have to check my food, because I didn't eat my food. I saw that damn snake hanging from the damn opening in the ceiling again on my way to 7th period. I arrived late, but Miles had already finished the lab by himself and, by some miracle, agreed to let me copy his results. I flipped open my notebook, glanced warily at Mrs. Dalton, and began copying. Miles watched me, When I got suspicious and looked up, he just quirked his eyebrow and kept staring, like a bored house cat. I snorted and kept writing. He followed me after class, hovering silently on my right side, the cat waiting for attention. Anyone else would have sparked a cascade of paranoia, but he didn't. "Sorry you had to do that lab alone," I said, knowing full well that it had been no trouble for him. "Those results look like..." "So where were you really?" He cut me off. "I know it wasn't mono." I stopped, looked around, waited for some kids to pass us.
"It was mono."
Miles rolled his eyes.
"Yeah, and my IQ was 25.
"Really, what were you doing?"
"Having mono?" I gave him the, "you really shouldn't push this any further" look. But apparently Miles Richter didn't understand everything, because he scoffed and moved in front of me, blocking my path.
"Yes. The symptoms of mono include reacting to things that aren't there, screaming for no reason at all, and flailing on the ground like you're about to be axe murdered."
My face flushed with heat. "It was mono," I whispered.
"You're schizophrenic."
I stood there, blinking stupidly.
"Say something, idiot."
If I didn't, he'd have no doubt.
"Say something. Say something."
I turned and walked away. I wanted to shoot Miles in the kneecaps more than ever. Accusations about my mental state were the cherry on top of the "I framed you for setting someone on fire Sunday." The dickiest of dickery. I could go to jail for the fire thing. Not only was Celia's dad a lawyer, but her family was loaded. We were so poor, my mother took 3/4 of my paycheck every week to supplement the family income. Theo assured me that if Miles really was the one running the job to set Celia's hair on fire, he wouldn't have let me take the fall for it. Not something that serious. I didn't know if I believed her. Some of the things Miles did for money were pretty out there. He'd actually abducted someone's ex-boyfriend's beloved golden retriever. After that, I avoided him. I tried to avoid Celia, too. She walked around the school complaining about attempts on her life. She glared at me constantly and flipped her hair whenever I was near, highlighting how short she'd been forced to cut it. Even Stacy and Brittany seemed a little wary of Celia now, as if she'd set the fire herself. I didn't talk to Miles for most of the week, not even in our lab on Wednesday when I broke our watch glass, spilling chemicals all over the table. Miles bent down to pick up the pieces. Then, since our lab was ruined, he fabricated data that ended up being more accurate than anyone else's. When I walked into the gym at the end of the day on Thursday, Art and Jetta sat playing cards on one end of the bleachers. Miles was stretched out on the row above them, his battered notebook open over his face. The cheerleading squad practiced on the other side of the gym, their voices echoing off the walls. As I approached the club, Art leaned back and nudged Miles in the ribs. "Hey." I sat down beside Jetta. A solid 2 feet separated us, but it still counted.
"What's up?" said Art. "Did anyone say anything to you about the fire?"
Miles lifted the edge of his notebook and peeked out. When our eyes met, he groaned.
"Not really. Weird looks, but not much else.
I didn't do it."
"We know. Celia did," said Art.
I stared at him.
"What?" "Celia did it to herself. We went back and interrogated her."
You interrogated her?
"What'd you do, threaten to take her makeup off and reveal her secret identity?"
"Mein chef said he would shave her eyebrows off."
Jetta smiled brightly.
"Among other things, she told us everything. She set the fire herself. Stacy and Brittany had the water, and she blamed it on you."
"Mein chef? Was she talking about Miles?" I looked up at him, but he only grunted.
"It's a good thing Stacy and Brittany put her out when they did," said Art. "If they'd let her burn, you'd have been in deep shit."
"We," said Jetta. deep sheet.
Miles groaned again. I whipped around. What's wrong with you?
Maybe I don't want to tell you, he snapped.
He sat up long enough to procure a pen from thin air and jot something down in his notebook. The side of his left hand was smeared with black ink from his pinky to his wrist. Maybe his notebook contained a list of his mafia jobs. Or all the people who owed him money. Maybe. Ooh, maybe it was a hit list. Bet I was on there a couple hundred times. Calculus homework by itself was a bitch, but when you added the screams and giggles of the East Shoal cheerleading squad, it became unbearable. I plowed my way through a half hour of derivatives before the cheerleaders quieted and the coach addressed them.
So, ladies, said Coach Privet,
a 40-something squat gym teacher with scraggly dark hair.
Basketball season is here, and it's time to pick another cheer captain.
Hannah put in her 2 cents, and I agree with her.
Who is it?
Someone called. The whole group giggled. Coach Privet said,
Drum roll, please.
And the girls pounded their feet on the floor. Art and Jetta stopped their card game long enough to shoot the cheerleaders dirty looks. Miles flopped onto his side in annoyance. Celia sat among the cheerleaders, like a hyena in front of a bloody haunch of meat. She had that deadly, obsessive look in her eyes that girls got when they knew what they wanted and were going to do anything to get it. The same look she had whenever she laid eyes on Miles. Which made no sense to me. What girl in her right mind would be obsessed with Miles? I wasn't even obsessed with him. Me, who thought he might be Blue Eyes. And who had come to the unfortunate conclusion that even if he wasn't Blue Eyes, I still didn't mind noting the way he raked his hair to the side when it fell over his forehead, or how he stretched his legs out exactly 20 minutes into each class. At least my attention to him was because I couldn't get away from him. Celia had to have a different reason. Coach Privet clapped her hands together.
And the new cheer captain is...
They sucked in a collective breath.
Brittany Carver!
A ripple ran through the girls, and then lots of cheering and clapping, and Brittany squealed and stood and made a little bow. Celia did not cheer, and she did not clap. Her entire face flushed with color as she gazed at her alleged best friend with cold-blooded murder in her wide, rabid eyes. I could imagine it as a cartoon. Celia's teeth turning into fangs and steam blowing out her ears as she grabbed Brittany around the neck and throttled her until Brittany's eyes popped out of her head. When Coach Privet concluded the meeting and the cheerleaders dispersed, Celia still stood there, hands balled at her sides. Jaw clenched. Her eyes made a quick sweep of the gym and saw me watching her. I looked down at my book. She turned and stomped across the gym and stood underneath the scoreboard. Was it possible for someone to act the way she did because that was just the way she was? Or was there always a reason? I'd like to think if someone saw me acting strangely, they wouldn't assume it was because I was a bad person. Or they'd at least ask if something was wrong before they made the decision.
Boss, are we done here?
Art asked. Miles, who had fallen asleep, jolted awake and mumbled something about going home. We gathered up our bags and headed to the exit. I was the last one out, and right before the doors closed, the yelling started. But it wasn't Celia's voice. I jerked around in surprise and stuck my head back into the gym. Standing under the scoreboard with Celia, her back to me, was a woman in a sharp business suit, her blonde hair waving down to the middle of her back. I glanced over my shoulder. Miles and the others were still walking, too far away to have heard. Celia's head was down, both hands up by her ears, like she was ready to block out everything around her.
"I thought it would be okay," she said.
"I thought... that you had the situation under control?"
The woman's voice was sickly sweet, with an undercurrent of poisonous. I had heard that voice before. At the volleyball game on the first day of school.
I did,
Celia whined.
I don't know why. I knew they were going to pick me.
But they didn't. You want to explain that?
I don't know.
Celia fisted one hand in her hair.
I did everything exactly like you told me. I did it all right.
Apparently not, said the woman. You wasted your time with that stunt you pulled at the bonfire. You've undermined yourself and you're ruining my plans. Where do you expect to go now?
I don't even like cheerleading. And Brittany's my friend.
Your friend? You call that bitch your friend? You need to do something about her, Celia. You need to show her that she doesn't deserve that position. Celia whimpered something unintelligible. And then you go around thinking a boy will make this all better, the woman snapped. Blood-red fingernails tapped against her arm. You've known him for 5 years, and he's hardly looked at you. He threatened to shave your eyebrows off. He's an obstacle, Celia. One you need to remove.
No, he's not.
I'm your mother. I know these things. Her mother? Celia was crying now. She turned away from her mother to wipe her eyes, smudging her ugly mascara tears. Something slipped out of her hand and clattered to the floor, making her jump. Her cell phone. When she bent down to get it, she saw me. Her eyes opened wide. I ran from the gym as fast as I could.
Do you ever think about lobsters?
Very doubtful.
I think about lobsters all the time.
You knew that already. I've told you the stories.
Yes.
Do you think the lobsters in the tank try to help the other lobsters? Is that why they pile up like that? Or is it just for company? Because they know they're all doomed.
Better not tell you now.
Either way, it must be nice to have someone. Chapter 20. I told Tucker about Celia and her mother the next day, when we both had to work the late shift at Finnegan's. And her mom just showed up at school? Tucker said. I didn't think they got along. I'd been considering the idea that the encounter had been some kind of hallucination, but there was confirmation. Even Tucker knew about Celia's mom. Well, they sure didn't sound happy to see each other. I think her mom must have been watching, I said. She was right there after we walked out. But when Celia saw me, I swore she was going to fly across the gym and strangle me to death. Tucker shook his head.
Add it to Celia's list of weird conversations.
What does that mean?
Did you know McCoy talks to Celia all the time?
He asked.
He calls her to his office all the time. I used to be the front desk attendant sophomore year, and a week into September, Celia started showing up every other day. Into McCoy's office. Stayed for half an hour. Waltzed back out again. And she's been doing that ever since. Think that was included in her mom's plans?
McCoy? No, I don't think McCoy is included in anyone's plans.
Speaking of McCoy,
Tucker leaned against the counter and clipped his mechanical pencil to the frames of his glasses.
Talking about the scoreboard legend a while back got me curious. I'm going to the library on Saturday to research. Want to come? I'll pick you up.
I thrust out my hand.
Deal.
Though I felt better after telling Tucker what I'd seen, I spent the next days wondering if Celia was going to jump out and stab me. She didn't, but she did shoot me warning looks that said I'd get shanked if I went near her. I was still jittery on Friday. I sat on a bench outside school and waited for the parking lot to quiet down. There were still way too many cars around, and I didn't want to take Irwin into that sort of hostile environment. The lights cast wide yellow pools on the asphalt. Most kids had stayed inside for some sort of basketball after-party in the gym, and anyone out here was in their car and gone within minutes. Except for one person. I spotted her when she crept out from behind a row of cars. Celia. She had a can of paint in one hand, and she shook it as she peered over her shoulder. Abandoning my backpack on the bench, I darted down the next row of cars. I kneeled between two cars and watched her lean over the hood of a white convertible and paint the windshield. I pointed my camera. A minute later, Captain Bitch in neon pink covered the convertible's windshield. Oh, great. Celia listened to her mom. Cheerleader retribution. The camera slipped from my fingers and clattered on the asphalt. Celia whipped around, saw me kneeling there. I scooped up the camera and sprinted in the other direction. Celia screamed something, and the paint can hit the hood of a car as I passed by. It burst open, spraying fluorescent pink everywhere. I veered left, ducking down so Celia wouldn't see my head. I glanced through a car window. She raced down the row after me. I crawled along, doubled back, and passed her before rolling underneath a van.
Ridgemont!
I could see her sneakers. She walked back the other way. I held my breath as she passed the van. Please, please let me be hallucinating this. Because if I wasn't, that meant Celia Hendricks really was losing it. Maybe her mom was pushing her there. Or maybe she'd always been like this. But I was pretty sure if she found me right now, she was going to rip my hair out. My salvation came a few seconds later.
Milesy!
Celia squealed.
What are you doing, Hendricks?
Miles's feet, shiny shoes and all, came into view. He always walked like that. Heel, toe, push. Like he'd knock over anyone who got in his way.
Oh, nothing, just hanging out. You?
Now they were both planted right in front of the van.
Nothing,
he replied. His voice was low and sharp.
Just wondering why you're running around the parking lot screaming your head off.
Celia hesitated.
No reason. I have to get going, but I'll see you tomorrow.
She hurried off, and a moment later an engine started up. Miles was still there. I held my breath. If he'd move, I could go get Erwin and leave. I wanted him to find me under this van about as much as I wanted Celia to. He couldn't see me like this. But then, he walked to the van's front bumper, kneeled down, and peered underneath.
Having fun?
He asked. I let out a gust of breath and set my forehead against the asphalt. What an asshole.
Running from crazy people is always fun, I replied.
Miles helped me out from under the van. As I brushed myself off, he asked,
So what was she chasing you for?
That depends, I said, bringing up the picture of Celia spray-painting Brittany's car on my camera. I showed it to him. Please be there. Please be there.
What do you see?
He pushed his glasses up and stared at it for a moment.
I see Celia getting angry about her cheerleading position and taking it out on Brittany Carver's car, with some offensively bright paint.
I almost hugged him.
Oh, good.
Are you going to tell Brittany?
He asked.
Why? Do you think she'd believe me? With this evidence, sure. But good luck getting to her with Celia around.
I'll probably give these to Mr. Guntree or someone on Monday.
Give them to Claude.
Why?
He'll give them to his dad, and he'll make sure everyone knows about it.
That seems excessively mean.
Celia was prepared to beat you to a bloody pulp a few minutes ago, he pointed out.
I made a mental note to go to the newspaper room on Monday morning and give Claude the pictures. Miles and I walked back up to the school. The crickets and cicadas had faded for the year, leaving the night quiet and undisturbed. Miles's truck was parked against the curb, near Irwin's bushes. The light outside the school's front entrance illuminated the whole front walk. I grabbed Irwin's handlebars. The front half of my bike slipped free of the bush. Only the front half. Someone had cut my bike in half. It had been rusting away in the middle, but I was positive I'd get at least another semester out of the poor thing. Anger welled up in my chest.
Someone cut my bike in half.
Pressure built up behind my eyes. I had no transportation. My mother would call me careless for letting this happen. She'd give me a lecture about respecting my possessions, even though I'd heard it 1,000 times before. I wiped my eyes on the back of my sleeve and forced the knot back down my throat. Dad had bought me Irwin. Brought Irwin all the way from Egypt. He was basically an artifact. One of the few things I had from Dad that I knew for sure was real. He was priceless. And now he was broken. I grabbed the back half and rounded on Miles, who still stood a few feet behind me, looking mildly surprised.
"Did you do this?" I asked.
"No." "Right." I grabbed my bag from the bench and started down the sidewalk.
"You're going to walk home?"
"Yep."
"Great plan."
He planted himself in front of me.
"I can't let you. Not in the dark."
"Well, that's too bad, isn't it?" I wondered when he'd decided to become a white knight. "I didn't ask for your permission."
"And I won't ask for yours," he retorted. "I will throw you in my truck."
"And I will scream rape," I replied evenly. He rolled his eyes.
"I didn't cut your bike in half, I swear."
"Why should I believe you? You're kind of notorious for being a lying, thieving bastard." He shrugged. "You don't explain yourself to anyone, do you?" He motioned to his truck.
"Will you please get in?"
I looked around quickly. Finding another ride home would be pretty impossible. And as I looked out at the dark, quiet street, it occurred to me that walking home wasn't the best idea ever. Sure, I hung around Red Witch Bridge in the middle of the night, but that was in the cover of the trees with an urban legend and a baseball bat as weapons. Here, I was a teenaged girl with average upper body strength, hair like a signal beacon, and a mental condition that could make me think I was being attacked even when I wasn't. At least I knew Miles well enough to understand that the look of frustration on his face wasn't a ploy. So I tossed the two halves of Irwin into the back of his truck and climbed into the passenger seat. The cab still smelled like pastries and mint soap. I breathed in deeply, without realizing it, and hastily let it out as a sigh. Miles glanced through the driver's side window, let out a quick curse, and grabbed a stack of papers on the seat.
"Sorry. I have to drop these off. I forgot. I'll be right back."
He hurried into the school. The papers must have been his stat charts for the week, but I found it hard to believe he'd forgotten them. Miles didn't forget things. His truck was surprisingly clean. The dash had been stripped bare, the radio front was smashed in, and the knob for the heater was missing. Miles had stashed his backpack behind the driver's seat, apparently in a hurry, because it was on its side, and its contents spilled out in the cramped space. The corner of his black notebook peeked out beneath his chemistry book. This was my chance. I could just take a look. Get a glimpse at the tip of Miles Richter's psychological iceberg. I checked to make sure he was still safely inside East Shoal, then pulled the notebook out. It was bound in leather. There were several pieces of paper clipped to the inside back cover, but I ignored them and flipped it open to the middle. Both pages were covered with his untidy scrawl. I went back to the beginning and skimmed through. Math equations filled whole pages. There were symbols I'd never seen, and little notes scribbled off to the sides. There were quotes from books, and more notes. There were lists of scientific classifications for plants and animals, and even more lists for words I'd never encountered. There were entire passages written in German, dated like journal entries. I noticed familiar names, like my own, and the other members of the club. And then, separated from the rest of the scribbles by a few blank pages, like he'd wanted to remember these things specifically, were short 1-2 sentence declarations, marked with the dates they'd been written. Intelligence is not measured by how much you know, but by how much you have the capacity to learn. You are never as great or as pitiful as you think you are. Those who are picked last are the only ones who truly know what it feels like. Schools without bike racks should be convicted of criminal negligence. I stared at that last line, dated on the first day of school, urging it to change, to revert to its true form, because I knew I must have made it up. If that wasn't a quote from somewhere, if that was one of his own observations, then he'd lied about not standing up to Cliff for me. Celia had scoffed at Irwin, and Cliff had stood in my way, and Miles had said he hadn't done any of it for me. This notebook didn't sound like Miles. It sounded like someone a lot more naive than Miles. Someone who really liked to know things. Scientific classifications. Complex math. Words. I looked up. Miles was coming out of the school. Groaning, I stuffed the notebook back under his chemistry book. I faced forward, trying to look inconspicuous. He slid into the driver's seat. "Is something wrong?" he asked. "You seem to have forgotten that someone cut my bike in half."
"And you seem to have forgotten that I have a truck," said Miles. "I can give you a ride. To school, at least."
"No, thanks," I said.
"Really? I'm not joking. Unless you're that against having anything to do with me. I don't care. You can get in line."
He turned onto the main road. The line from the notebook felt like a dead weight in my stomach.
"No, not against it."
I realized with a strange sort of happy dread that we were falling back into the easy conversation we'd had at the bonfire. "But I'd like to know why you're offering."
"What do you mean?"
Honest confusion crossed his face.
"Isn't that a good thing to do?"
I burst out laughing. "Since when have you been good? Are you feeling guilty or something?"
"A little sentimental, maybe. My first idea was to drive up and down in front of you a few times to prove I had a car and you didn't."
His tone was light, and he was smiling. Holy crap, he was smiling. A real, teeth-showing, nose-scrunching, eyes-crinkling smile. The smile slipped off his face.
"What? What's wrong?"
"You were smiling," I said. "It was kind of weird."
"Oh," he said, frowning. "Thanks."
"No, no, don't do that." The smile was better. The words felt wrong coming out of my mouth. I shouldn't say things like that to him. But they hung neatly in the air and cleared out the tension. Miles didn't smile again. He turned down my street and pulled into my driveway. "Charlie's playing her violin again," I said. The music floated out of the house like a bird on a breeze. The 1812 Overture. I had to throw my weight against the passenger door to get it open. "The smile was better," I said again as I closed the door behind me, the words sounding less awkward now. "I think people would like you if you did it more."
"What's the point, though?" said Miles. "So, Monday."
"Monday.
Should I be here?"
"Do you want to be here?" He looked like a cat eyeing its prey.
7 o'clock. After that, I'm leaving without you. Do you work tonight?"
"Yes."
"Guess I'll see you there." "And Alex."
"Yeah?"
"I won't tell anyone, in case you were wondering."
I knew what he meant, and I knew he was telling the truth. There was something in his voice that said he understood. I believed him. I fished Irwin out of the truck bed. Then I propped the halves up against the garage door and headed inside as Miles drove down the street. My head spun with everything that had happened. Celia's revenge. Irwin. The increasingly plausible idea that Blue Eyes was not a hallucination at all, and never had been. My mother let me get 10 steps inside the front door before bombarding me with questions. Who was that? What happened to your bike? Did you forget you have to work tonight? And my personal favorite. Do we need to have the talk? I cringed. I did not need to think of Miles in that way. I was plenty confused about him as it was. No, we do not need to have the talk, Mom. I understand how boy and girl parts work. Yes, I have to go to Finnegan's. No, I don't know what happened to Erwin. Who was that in the truck? She waved her empty coffee mug around. I couldn't tell if she was angry or excited. Her zealotry managed to cover pretty much all the emotional bases. That was Miles. Chapter 21. I giggled a little when I found out the librarian I'd accused of being a communist 5 years ago still worked at the library. I giggled a little more when Tucker and I walked in and she glared at me. She remembers me, I whispered to Tucker, grinning. Tucker snorted and pulled me to a section of the library in the back, where several aging computers sat in a line against the wall. We took the 2 open computers at the end. I can't believe they don't have these records online, Tucker said, clicking incessantly at his yellowed mouse. The old computer wheezed as it started up. I don't even think these are connected to the Internet. I don't think they have Ethernet ports. Oh, God, what if they don't have network cards? You make it sound like the 90s were hell, I said. They probably were. Our childish naivete saved us. The computers blinked to life and allowed us to access the newspaper archives from the desktop. The catalog seemed recently updated, despite looking like a victim of 1990s pattern choice. Okay, so I'm thinking there must have been something to spark this scoreboard legend, Tucker said. Look for anything that says anything about East Shoal or the scoreboard itself. I didn't mind scouring old newspaper articles. They were still forms of history, just slightly more recent than I was used to. 20 minutes later, I found the first clue, one that I'd already seen before. Scarlett Fletcher, captain of the East Shoal cheerleading squad, helps introduce Scarlett's Scoreboard, a commemoration of the charity and goodwill her father, Randall Fletcher, has shown toward the school. I turned my screen toward Tucker. He frowned. I thought the scoreboard was older than that. This was 20 years ago. In the picture, Scarlett beamed and flashed a set of white teeth. Her face wasn't obscured here. She looked vaguely familiar. There was another picture at the bottom of the article. Scarlett stood beneath the scoreboard with a boy with dark hair, wearing a football captain's uniform. His smile was strained. "He's hot," I said absentmindedly.
"Sure, if you like the classical look," Tucker mumbled.
"What was that?"
"Nothing, nothing."
"Are you jealous, Mr. Soggy Potato Salad?"
"Jealous? When I've got this?"
Tucker whipped off his glasses, bit the tip of the earpiece, and squinted at me. I laughed. The librarian sprang out from behind a bookcase and shushed me. I clapped a hand over my mouth. We returned our attention to our search.
"Hey, here's something," Tucker said. "Not about the scoreboard, but it mentions Scarlett again."
He turned his screen to me. "Though only numbering 151, East Shoal's graduating class of 1992 includes several remarkable names, including Scarlett Fletcher, daughter of the politician Randall Fletcher, and the class valedictorian, Juniper Richter, who tested top in the nation in both math and language comprehension." I let my voice fade away. "Is that?"
"It's Miles' mom, yeah."
"They went to school together? That means she was there when the scoreboard went up. Maybe she could tell you something about it." Tucker rubbed his neck.
"That's probably not going to happen."
"Why not?"
"She's, in a mental hospital up in Goshen."
A mental hospital?
I paused.
Why?
Tucker shrugged. I don't know anything else. She calls Finnegan sometimes when he's there. One time I redialed after he'd hung up, and an orderly answered. He waved his hand around. And now you see why I don't mind eavesdropping on people's personal lives.
I sank back in my chair. You're sure?
Yeah. Are you okay?
I nodded. That was why I'd trusted Miles when he said he wouldn't tell anyone. He knew what it meant to hide a secret like that. I dove back into the articles, trying to shove thoughts of Miles and his mother and Blue Eyes to the back of my mind. I had a strange, intense desire to see him. My eyes began to glaze over and my legs went numb right about the same time I found it. I was well into 97 when the headline reached right off the screen and smacked me in the face. Memorial Scoreboard Falls. Crushes Donor's Daughter.
You're kidding me, I whispered.
I think I just found your story, Tucker.
What?
Scarlett died in 97, I said. The scoreboard fell on her when she went back for the class reunion. And, Jesus, McCoy was the one who tried to lift it off of her. He was electrocuted. Scarlett died in the hospital a few hours later from sustained injuries, and they hung the scoreboard back up. I showed him the article. His eyes widened as he read.
McCoy went to school with Scarlett, Tucker said. McCoy tried to save her and couldn't. Now he worships the scoreboard because...
Why?
It killed somebody.
He sat back, raked his hands through his neatly combed hair, and stared at me.
How messed up is this guy?
It didn't just kill somebody, I said. It killed Scarlett. He's made it like a monument, a memorial for her. A memorial for a dead woman. There was definitely something strange going on. I just didn't know what it was. Chapter 22. I sat in the copse on the hill behind Red Witch Bridge that night, trying for a little while to forget what I'd learned in the library. Not the part about Scarlett, even though that was interesting. It was the information about Miles, about his mother, that had kept me from falling asleep. The night was quiet aside from the breeze ruffling the leaves and the whisper of the stream. Most cars didn't come down this road at night because of the bridge. People said it was because they didn't trust the bridge's integrity, but the real reason was the witch. A long time ago, back in the days when people still got pressed to death, a witch lived on this side of the river. Not the misunderstood kind of witch who only wants to deal with her chants and herbal remedies, but the creepy kind who cuts off crow heads and eats children and small pets. So the witch was fine, or so the story goes, most of the time because everyone else lived on the other side of the river and didn't bother her. But then they built the bridge, and people started coming onto her land, and she got pissed. She would wait by the bridge at night and kill those unlucky enough to cross after dark. Eventually she got pressed to death or something. But even now, when a car drove across the bridge at night, you could hear the witch scream. She was called the Red Witch because she was coated with the blood of her victims. I was probably the only teenager in the state who wasn't scared of the witch. Not because I was extra fearless or anything, but because I knew where the legend came from. Two sets of headlights appeared around the bend in the road. I scooted farther behind my tree, cracking twigs and fallen leaves, even though I knew they wouldn't see me. The cars pulled off on the shoulder. Doors opened and closed. Voices floated to me. Words scrambled. A girl's high-pitched giggle, a boy's low murmur. Teenagers come to play with the witch. The headlights threw their long-legged shadows across the pavement. There were five of them. Four in the first car, one in the second. All with their shoulders huddled up around their ears in the chilly autumn air. The first four seemed to be reasoning with the fifth. The girl giggled again. The fifth person broke away from the group and started across the bridge. His steps echoed against the old wood. Brave guy. Usually it took more persuasion. The others wouldn't be able to see him when he reached my side because of the trees. But if he walked up the hill, the moonlight would let me see him. He crossed the bridge and stood in the darkness, looking around. Then he started up the hill. Miles? I stood and stepped out of the trees. I should have known. I didn't want to freak him out or anything, but he still stopped in his tracks and stared at me. Alex? What are you doing here? What are you doing here? No, I asked first. And since you are literally chilling here behind these trees and no one does that at Red Witch Bridge at night, your answer is infinitely more important than mine. Well, you do it when you're the witch. He stared at me. You're the witch. I'm the witch. I shrugged. You sit out here at night and scare people? No, I said. I sit out here at night and watch people scare themselves. It's fun. What are you doing here? Miles motioned over his shoulder. Cliff, Rhea, and some others pooled their money to pay me to walk the bridge at night. I didn't bother to tell them I don't believe in urban legends. Maybe they figured if the legend was true, the witch would get you out of their way.
Richter! Find anything?
I recognized Cliff's voice. Miles looked back and sighed. Want to mess with them? I asked. I pulled him down the hill with me, and we stood at the other end of the bridge, in the darkness of the trees where the others couldn't see us. Okay. All you have to do is yell at the top of your lungs.
Right now?
Right now. Like you're being attacked. Miles took a deep breath and yelled. Cliff and the others jumped, but didn't move. Miles' voice died out.
Come on, Richter. We know you're trying to...
I screamed. A good ear-shattering chainsaw killer bloody murder scream. Cliff stumbled backward, fell over, and had to scramble to his feet again. Rhea screeched. The other two fled to their car, followed by Cliff and Rhea, and peeled away. Miles and I stood there for another few moments, silent and waiting. The cold bit at my cheeks.
Do you do this all the time?
Miles asked finally. No, just today. I smiled. He stared at me.
What?
I said.
Why are you here?
I told you, I'm the witch.
How are you the witch?
I sighed and swung my arms back and forth, wondering if I should tell him. He had that look on his face again, like he understood what was going on in my head. Around us, the wind rustling the trees sounded like thousands of voices.
Scythiorism, Miles said, looking up at the forest around us.
What?
Scythiorism. It's a low whispering sound, like wind in the leaves.
I sighed again. The wind blew his mint soap and pastry scent toward me. I had a bad week a while back, I said finally, when I was at Hill Park. I snuck out of the house at night because, you know, I thought that communists were kidnapping me. Came down here screaming my head off. Apparently I scared some potheads. My parents found me sleeping under the bridge the next morning. They were mortified.
Because you slept under a bridge? Mortified isn't the word I'd use.
I was naked.
Oh.
They were angry, too. At least my mother was. Dad was worried.
Were you okay? The potheads didn't do anything to you?
No. I scared the crap out of those guys.
That wasn't that long ago, then. How'd the story get around so fast? I shrugged. Beats me. People communicate surprisingly well when they're scared. They just don't communicate the right things. The breeze ruffled the leaves over our heads. Sithurism. I'd have to remember that. I desperately wanted to ask Miles about his mom, but I knew this wasn't the time. I sat down in the middle of the gravel road and patted a spot next to me. "Cars rarely come down this way," I said. Miles sat down. He folded his long legs and balanced his arms on his knees, bunching his bomber jacket up around his ears. The breeze had mussed his hair. I balled my hands in my lap to keep from reaching over and putting it back in place. "I didn't see you at Finnegan's tonight," I said. "I didn't get a shift at the store today. Went home after school." Didn't get a shift. Like he wanted one. "I don't understand you," I said, the realization hitting me at the same time I said it. Miles leaned back on his hands.
"Okay."
"Okay?" He shrugged.
"I don't understand you either, so I guess we're even. But I don't understand most people."
"That's weird."
"How so?"
"People aren't hard to understand, except you. And you're so smart, I figured you had everyone on your puppet strings." He snorted.
"Puppet strings. Never heard it described like that before."
"I want to know what you do when you're not at school or work or running jobs. Where do you even live?"
"Why does it matter?"
I sighed again. He made me sigh a lot. "You're an enigma. You walk around doing stuff to people for money, and everyone's afraid to look you in the eye, and I'm pretty sure you're part of a mafia. You don't strike me as the kind of person who has a place to live. You're just there. You exist. You are where you are, and you have no home." The moonlight reflected off his glasses and lit up his eyes.
"I live a couple of streets away from here," he said. "The Lakeview Trail subdivision."
Lakeview Trail was one of those half-and-half subdivisions. Half pretty new houses like Downing Heights, half run-down hovels with crumbling sidewalks, like mine. I had a good feeling which side of the subdivision Miles belonged to.
"I'm not home most of the time. When I am, I try to sleep."
"But you don't." He was always tired. Always sleeping through first period. Always falling asleep over his meal at Finnegan's. He nodded.
"Most of the time I think about things. Write stuff down." "Is that what you wanted to know?"
"I guess." I became aware that we were staring at each other, and had been for a while. I noticed and looked away, but Miles didn't. "It's rude to stare at people."
"Is it?"
He sounded serious.
"Tell me if I'm doing something weird. Sometimes I can't tell."
"What is up with you lately? Why are you being so nice?"
"I didn't realize I was."
His face remained completely neutral, except for that infuriating eyebrow. I couldn't stand it anymore. I had to ask. "So do you think it's creepy? My schizophrenia?"
"That would be stupid."
I laughed. I fell back into the gravel and laughed, my voice carrying up through the trees and into the sky. His response made me feel free. That was what I came down to Red Witch Bridge to feel anyway. But I'd never expected any help from Miles. In a weird way, it felt like he belonged here. He belonged in the land of phoenixes and witches, the place where things were too fantastic to be real. He leaned over and looked down at me. He seemed more confused than anything. I pushed myself back up. He kept staring at me. I realized I wanted to kiss him. I didn't know why. Maybe it was the way he looked at me, like I was the only thing he wanted to look at. How did one go about it? Ask him if I could?
or maybe quick and unexpected would be better. He made a pretty easy target, sitting there, docile for once, and kind of sleepy. I really needed Finnegan's magic eight ball, but I could guess what kind of answer it would give me. Ask again later. So freaking non-committal. No. None of that. Decision? Outright questioning.
Just say it, said the voice.
Ask him. Blurt it out. What can he say? He can laugh in my face. Let him. It'll be a douche move on his part. You're only being honest.
I don't know.
Do you really think after all this he'd brush you off like that?
Maybe.
Maybe he likes you too. Maybe that's why he stares so much.
Maybe.
Screw it. I was chickening out. Quick and unexpected. Go! I leaned forward and kissed him. I don't think he caught on until it was too late. He froze up as soon as I touched him. Of course, he didn't like to be touched. I should have asked. I should have asked. Oh, I should have asked! But then, like a building wave, I felt the heat pouring off of him. His fingertips brushed my neck. My heart tried to strangle me, and I jumped away from him. A band of moonlight lit up his eyes like fluorescent bulbs. Sorry, I said, standing and hurrying back to the cops to find my baseball bat, trying to figure out what I'd been thinking. He was still sitting there when I stumbled back into the street. So, my jaw tingled, lungs contracted, throat tightened. I'll see you on Monday, I guess. He didn't say anything. I barely kept myself from sprinting through Redwich Bridge. The wind thundered in the trees. And when I finally looked back, Miles stood at the door to his truck, outlined by moonlight, staring right back at me. Chapter 23. I spent the rest of the weekend wondering what I was going to say to Miles on Monday. We both knew secrets about each other now. The only difference was he didn't know that I knew. It felt unfair somehow, like I was lying to him. When I woke up on Monday morning, I remembered the pictures on my camera and wondered how long it would take Celia to find me and kill me after I'd handed them over to Claude. Tucker and I had exhausted the library's databases on Scarlet and McCoy, with no further clues about McCoy's particular brand of psychosis. So either I asked Celia what exactly was going on with McCoy, she probably wouldn't give me a straight answer, or I found another source of information. I told myself to drop it. I told myself it wasn't worth it. But then I looked at the picture of Celia spray-painting that car, and all I could see was myself spray-painting the Hill Park gymnasium. 2 minutes before 7, Miles' truck idled in the driveway, tailpipe gushing exhaust into the frosty air. My mother stood at the front door, holding her coffee mug in both hands, her face pressed against the screen. I would have gotten mad at her, but she'd bought me a case of Yoo-Hoo over the weekend. So I poked her out of the way as I shouldered my backpack and grabbed a Yoo-Hoo from the hallway table. "That's Miles?" My mother shifted to see better when Miles let his arm dangle out the truck window, as if that arm would give her his life story. "Yes, he brought me home after the bonfire, remember? And on Friday." "You should invite him over for dinner." I laughed into the Yoo-Hoo straw, making the drink bubble up. My face got hot.
"Ha, right. You need to learn to be more sociable, Alexandra, or you're never going to..."
"Okay, bye, Mom. Love you." I charged past her and out the door. She huffed loudly as the screen door clattered shut. I jogged down the front yard, perimeter checking as I went, and climbed into Miles's pickup. "So how was your weekend?" I asked, trying to sound casual. His gaze snapped up to my face. I think he'd been staring at the Yoo-Hoo bottle, and he shrugged.
"Same as usual."
He left something hanging in the air, like he wanted to finish with, "except for Saturday night." "Same here, buddy."
He backed into the street. "You work at Meyer, right?" I asked.